listening to Radio Arian at RadioArian.com.
Welcome to Arian Insights. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I'm very pleased to announce today that we are going to be welcoming a very special guest, somebody whose work I've been following for since before I got involved in nationalism, really. He's one of the foremost experts on the Jewish revolutionary spirit, which is actually the title of one of his books, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History. He's also written a book entitled Libido Dominandi, which is the first one that caught my attention, really, which was talking about sexual liberation and political control. I'm, of course, talking about Professor E. Michael Jones. And I may not entirely agree with everything, every part of his research, but I would say that I agree with about 99% of it. It's only on a few issues that, that I don't actually agree. And I think you're going to find this interview with him very interesting, particularly, the end there, the end of it, when I ask him how we can, keep the alt-right from becoming hijacked by the Jews. He does have, some rather controversial views on race. He doesn't really think there is a white race, but that's due to originally us being ethnic nations. And you were either an Englishman or an Irishman, a Scotsman, a Dutchman or a German. We weren't actually white until we were juxtaposed with Negroes. And there is actually a book written all about that, which is called White Supremacy and Negro Subordination, which I did a series of narrations for, which you might want to look up. And I've also done a couple of narrations actually from his book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, which you might want to look up as well. One of those was on the Jews and Julian the Apostate, and the other one was about the Jews in Poland. He also runs Culture Wars website. There are lots and lots of interviews of him on YouTube. We also have 30 or 40 copies of the audio from some of these YouTubes and the interviews that he's done before at our arianbootlegs.wordpress.com site. He's recently just given a speech at the London Forum with a massive audience, by the sound of it. And in the interview that that he agreed to do with us, what I hoped to do was bring up some of the points from his other interviews that I've thought were the most salient points and get him to expand on them again. So to sort of try and get all the most important parts of his research and sort of condense it all down into one podcast. I think we get most of them down for you. I hope that you're going to enjoy it. And if people are a little think it's a little bit too religious at the beginning, they just keep with it. And I also think it's quite important the part at the beginning describing the Logos and the Greek idea of Logos and how much of an important part it played in early Christianity. Of course, Christianity back then was very different to today, but you're going to hear all about that in the following interview. So I'll play the interview for you now. Hi, Mike. I'm really pleased that you've agreed to do this interview with us today. How are you doing today?
Just fine. Just fine.
Excellent. Excellent. I think we'll get straight into this then. Now, you say that the Jew has been a revolutionary since he first rejected Logos in the form of Christ. Now, could you explain to us what Logos means and how the rejection of it manifests itself?
Yeah, Logos is a term that came into existence in Greece in the middle of the 4th century when Anaxagoras started talking about the world being ruled by a mind or a manifestation of a mind, a divine mind. If you look at the Liddell-Hart's Greek-English dictionary, you'll get about 5 pages of English equivalents for the word Logos. In this was taken over by Christianity when St. John wrote his gospel in Greek. They took over basically all of Greek philosophy. And what you see, the Pope Benedict wrote about this in about 2005, around that time. And he said that the idea of Logos made an independent appearance in human history, independent of Christianity, but Christianity took it over. And when they wrote their scriptures in Greek, and what it means is basically that the universe is a reasonable and orderly place because God is a reasonable and orderly being, and everything that is created is a manifestation of God's providence, His power, His will to bring it about, and the reason that He has it is part of His being. And so this is the world that was created and spread throughout Western Europe in the period when Christianity was growing. Now, from the point of view of the Jews, obviously Logos is not a Jewish word, and it's not a Jewish concept. They came at this whole thing from a different perspective. They were God's chosen people. It was in many ways, a primitive and a tribal thing for the Jews. They basically, God chose them. They didn't do anything to merit His choice. They just chose them for some reason. And God gave them a set of instructions, and they followed those instructions. And they were special people. And if God told them to do it, that was it. They pretty much did it. So the idea of some type of universal rationality was not really part of the Jewish upbringing. It was there. There's no question it was there. If you look at the Psalms and they talk about the heavens and things like that, it's there, but it's not implicit. It's not as stark as in the Greek version. Well, the Jews, as part of their story, were waiting for a Messiah because they were in a terrible condition because of the sins of their forebears. As a matter of fact, the first human being committed a sin that burdened them with a kind of broken form of human nature. And they suffered under it. In spite of this special agreement, they broke it constantly. They were always getting into trouble. But God remained true to His promise, and the Messiah appeared. Now, at this point in history, the Jews have to either accept the Messiah or reject Him. God can't create a rational creature, which is what He did with man, and then suddenly abrogate this thing and say, okay, you don't have free will anymore. I'm going to force you to accept the Messiah. He wouldn't do that. And so the Jews then had to accept or reject Jesus Christ. Now, they had their own idea of who they were. As a matter of fact, they had gotten fairly rigid in their understanding of themselves. They thought of themselves as having the special people, but having special DNA. It was the beginning of racism. They said to Jesus Christ, there's a dispute with Jesus Christ that's reported in the Gospel of St. John, and they say, we are the sperma Abraham, which means we are the seed of Abraham, which means we have special DNA. And this is supposed to impress Jesus Christ, who happens to be the Son of God. Well, needless to say, He's not impressed. He said, God doesn't need your sacred DNA. We don't care about that. He could create anything. He could turn rocks into people. And secondly, what difference does it make what your DNA is? The crucial issue is how you act. And DNA does not tell you how to act. Your reason tells you how to act. And so as a result, they get into a heated discussion, and the Jews eventually reject Jesus Christ. Now, what do I mean by the Jews reject Jesus Christ? Obviously, there were many people who belonged to that group of people, if you want to call them Israel or the Hebrews, who accepted Jesus Christ. But in the Gospel of St. John, the term Jew has a negative meaning. It means rejecter of Christ. And so the majority, it probably was the majority, rejected Him because Jesus Christ didn't conform to their view. He wasn't the God they wanted. They wanted a powerful military leader. And so it came down to Annas and Caiaphas, the representatives of the Jews, standing in front of the cross and saying, if you come down from the cross, we'll worship you as the Messiah. In other words, you didn't meet our standards, and so we're going to reject you. As a matter of fact, we're going to conspire to kill you, which is what they did. Now, this is Logos. that they're rejecting, because Jesus Christ is God. And St. John tells us in the second sentence of his gospel, Kai Logos en Theos. God, Logos is God. And this is the Logos incarnate, which has never happened before in human history. And you reject him, you're rejecting Logos. Well, when you reject Logos, you're rejecting the order of the universe. Everything about the universe, from the internal, let's put it the way, the internal order, which is basically your mind, your soul, which is rational, which depends upon choosing good over evil. And the laws that allow us to do that are called moral laws. So you're rejecting them. The social order is based on a moral order. You're rejecting that. And when you reject that, you become a revolutionary. And that's what the Jews have been ever since. For 2,000 years, they have been in the forefront of every revolutionary movement. I tell this story in my book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And also, it manifested itself within 30 years of the death of Jesus Christ. In 70 AD, the Jews became actual revolutionaries. They rose up against the Roman Empire, and they were crushed. And during the counterattack, the Roman soldiers destroyed the temple. Now, this means that there's no more Jewish religion, because you can't have a Jewish religion without a temple, a priesthood, and sacrifice, and the Jews have not had that since. A rabbi got himself smuggled out, created a new religion called, it's called Judaism, but it's really not the religion of the Old Testament because it doesn't have a temple. It's the synagogue religion, which is basically a debating society, and their sacred book is called the Talmud, which is unending opinions about unending opinions. The Jews reaffirmed their revolutionary character 60 years later, in 131, when Simon Bar Kokhba rose up against the Roman Empire. That too was crushed. That rebellion was crushed after some initial successes, and the result was the complete obliteration of Jerusalem as a place, a city. It was replaced by a settlement called to the north called Aelia Capitolina. From that point in history on, the Jews had no center from which they could work as a people. They spread out all over the world, and everywhere they spread revolution. There's never been a time when the Jews were not involved in revolution, including the present. And in the present, as I mentioned in a speech I gave in London, the present form of revolution is gay marriage, certainly in the United States. And now, let's just leave it at gay marriage. The whole promotion of this latest phase of sexual revolution.
Well, that's fascinating. I know that a lot of our listeners will be interested, especially in the Greek aspect of that and the Greek influence on Christianity, and how this philosophy that came up with the Logos was part of the Greek way of looking at things and a more European way of looking at things. And Christ himself was that personified, was all that thought personified into one person. So by rejecting that one person, they end up rejecting all the order of the universe. Now, one of the things that I was wondering about is we know how depraved the Bolsheviks were in the 20th century. And I was wondering, were they that bad right back at the time of Titus and Vespasian? Is that something that's been continuous, these really depraved, violent acts and the sexual acts that or the sexual liberation that we see in the 20th century? I was wondering, was that aspect there right at the beginning in 70 AD and then after in the Bar Kokhba rebellion?
No. Sexual liberation is a technological phenomenon. You can't have sexual liberation without some form of technology or spreading it well. At that time, no, I would not say that there was a manifest form of some type of sexual liberation. It was straight up political rebellion. But the Jews were always involved in working with some type of other group of people. There are never enough Jews to create a revolution. Not with Bolshevism, not with neoconservatism, never. They never have enough. They function as often as the man behind the scenes, or Marx gave us the term the avant-garde of the revolution, die Vorhut der Revolution. And that's how they functioned at this time, too. There's evidence that they connived with Nero's wife to create that persecution of Christians. There's also evidence that they were heavily involved in the Arian crisis, which was a heretical movement. There's a rabbi, Israel Newman, who did a book on revolutionary movements, and he said basically the Jews were involved in every revolutionary, or he calls them reform movements, but that's pretty much the same thing. It's his euphemism for revolution. Yeah. They were involved in every reform movement in Europe. And it began right at the beginning, except what they call reform movements, the church called heresy, namely the Arian heresy. Cardinal Newman goes into great detail about the Jewish collaboration in the Arian heresy at that time.
Well, just to roll back a little bit there, the reason I was asking about this depravity, I've read two of the books of Flavius Josephus, and I've read the one with the wars in Jerusalem, and I can remember reading about them dressing up as women while they were doing this and putting makeup on. And I just wondered if that was something that went right back to that time, this promotion of homosexuality and actually dressing up like that, dressing up as women, whilst committing these really violent and barbaric acts on the people that were actually there, because they were doing this to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. There was one group of them that were revolutionary, and they were persecuting the other group that were still there. Obviously, the ones that became Christian fled to the hills, exactly as they were told to do, once that sort of thing started happening. But there were still some that were left there in the city that were then picked upon in the same way that the Jews picked upon the Russians later on in this Bolshevik revolution. So I just wondered whether you were aware of that.
Well, generally, sexual liberation is something you promote among your enemies as a strategy to weaken your enemies. But oftentimes you succumb to it yourself, too. And throughout their history, I think that the Jewish temptation to idolatry always had a sexual component to it, because we're talking about these sexual fertility religions. The worship of Baal and Astarte involved temple prostitution. So they succumbed to it at this time. The real orchestration of sexual revolution didn't come until later. I just don't feel that it was part of these. Well, now that you mention it, you can see it throughout the time of the Reformation, but it was never the major theme. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It was always there, but it was never like a major event. I guess that's the way I'd put it.
Right, it's just sort of debauchery that would take over them with the links with these fertility religions and the ultra-violence that they're involved in. I mean, it's all linked in together. We were talking about the early heresies that they were involved in, and we often hear a modern criticism of Christianity is that these Gnostic heresies were actually the genuine Christianity. So you just said they were involved with the Arian heresy, but were they involved with the Gnostic heresies as well, and would you class that as being revolutionary activity? I guess you would.
About 30 years ago, Elaine Pagels wrote a book called The Gnostic Gospels.
I know the one. I know
it. In which she talked about them as basically the beginning of feminism. And there were kind of feminist elements involved in that. I believe some of the Gnostic trinities would be God the Father, God the Mother, and God the Son. That was always alien to Christianity. It was never part of it. There was never a female deity in Christianity. God was always exclusively masculine. And so the Gnostic Gospels existed at that time, but they were always rejected as heretical. So I just don't see that as being real Christianity. The Christianity was just unique in a way that people found alien, I think. I think that the whole idea of just the Christological development in the early centuries, where they had to figure out was he God, was Jesus Christ God, or was he man? Well, they tried, you know, some people said it was just God. Some people said he was man. And then finally they had a council where they came up with the formula that he was true God and true man. So I think that when you look at these other gospels, they're not supernatural enough, because they're always based on some type of natural understanding of something that is not natural. It's supernatural. This is Hegel said that with the arrival of Christianity, God opened his own mind to man. I mean, man could come to some understanding that there had to be a God. I mean, you can find this in Greek philosophy. It's in Aristotle with the uncaused cause and the unmoved mover. That natural reason can say, look, this thing could not have brought itself into existence. Something else had to bring it into existence. But to go beyond that and to say that there are three parts to God, that's way beyond any natural type of understanding. And I think you'll find that there's normally a reaction to this, a natural reaction of people saying, no, that's too complicated. We're not going to go that far. And I think Islam is an example of that, where they simply rejected the Trinity. Islam arose in a period, in a place and a time, the Middle East at that time, which was shot through with these Christological heresies. And in many ways, the people, kind of people, perplexed people, heaving a sigh of relief, sort of, as the people, the Muslims come in and say, no, it's just one God. You know, it's not that complicated. It's just one. But in doing that, I think that you lose what Hegel said. You lose some type of unique insight into the mind of God that helps you to understand everything else. And the Trinity is that. There's no question about it. The Trinity helps you understand history and everything in a kind of dynamic way. And I think Hegel's a great example of it.
Well, I think once you start adding a goddess in there, that's like bringing equality into religion. I think that's...
Yeah, and it's kind of a natural thing. Sure, why are we leaving women out? Why are we discriminating against women? But that's the way it is. It's not that way. It's bigger than your natural categories.
It's bigger than the way of looking at it today. Well, once Christianity became the state religion of Rome and the Roman Empire, then there were some protections brought in to protect the Christians against the Jews. Can you talk about some of the things that Rome brought that was to actually protect the Christian people from some of the worst excesses of the Jews?
Yeah, once the Roman Empire collapsed. And the Germanic tribes sort of took over. The church became responsible for this, at least certainly the theoretical protection of social order. And so right early on, I believe it must have been like in, I think it was the 7th century, the church came up with a principle of how to deal with the Jews. And it was called Sicut Judaeus Non. And that became the backbone of church principle of dealing with the Jews all the way up to the present day. Let's say this Second Vatican Council. And it was basically a two-part principle. And it said, first of all, no one has the right to harm the Jew. And that extended to his services. You have no right to disrupt the services of the synagogue. We tolerate them. They are not the official state religion, but we'll tolerate them because there's some type of mystery involved here that's greater than all of us. So we're going to tolerate. We're going to allow them to have their services. They're not officially accepted, and you have no right to disturb them. You have no right to desecrate Jewish cemeteries. On the other hand, and here's the second part, the Jew has no right to undermine Christian culture. Either by undermining the faith or the morals of the Christian people. Now, the Jews could not be citizens in these Christian cultures. They were accepted there. They were tolerated. And if they violated these things, they could be expelled and they would lose their citizenship. And this happened frequently because the Jews were, let's face it, constantly, they have a kind of compulsion to be revolutionaries. And when this means revolutionary in the day-to-day practice means to undermine Christian culture, to corrupt the morals of Christians. Because once the morals are corrupted, they're weaker and then they're easier to control. And so it would extend to ramify into all sorts of regulations. So in Poland, the church would say, you know, women should not be employed by Jewish men as their house servants or maids, because the Jew would invariably try to seduce them. It was bad for their morals to do this kind of stuff. And so they dealt with it that way. I think it provides a rational framework for dealing with a problem. First of all, you have to admit that it's a problem, you know, and then secondly, it deals with the problem by safeguarding the rights. Let's not so much the rights. The Jews didn't have rights, but safeguarding the well-being of the Jew by protecting him from harm, from violence, which took place often and frequently. I mean, frequently throughout the Middle Ages, largely because of Jewish involvement in usury. But it also protected Christian culture as well from the subversion that the Jews were expert at practicing.
And before this, I guess it would have been that they were living among the Arab nations. I know that in the Byzantine times, there were laws that they couldn't own Christian slaves, they couldn't hold public office. So what you were talking about there is taking us up to the times when they were actually in Europe. But I was just wondering, when they were living in the Arab lands, when you're saying that this Islam took hold, did they start any revolutions there at all? Or was it just these Gnostic heresies that they were floating around?
Well, I mean, if you jump way ahead, they were involved in Kemal Ataturk's revolution in the 20th century. They were known as Donmeh. That was a secularizing revolution, and the Jews were heavily involved in supporting, bringing about the secular state in Turkey. But that's all the way into the 20th century. To dial that back a little bit, what were all those Jews doing in Turkey to begin with? Well, a lot of them came there because of the expulsion from Spain in 1492. And what were they doing in Spain? Well, they were working with the Moors. Because whenever it came to a choice of enemies, their enemy was always the Christian. Christianity was their enemy. They learned this from generation to generation to generation. They were obsessed with the person of Jesus Christ. They were obsessed with discrediting him as a Messiah. The Talmud is full of descriptions of him being buried in burning excrement in hell. The Talmud claims that his mother was a whore and so on and so forth. So when it came to Spain, during the era of the Moors swept into Spain and conquered it, almost conquering all of Europe as part of that first wave of Islamic conquest. And they were stopped at the Pyrenees. And gradually what took place was the Reconquista. And finally, in the final days, they were the Spaniards united and drove the Moors back into Africa. And the Jews were collaborating with them during this period of time. At the same time, there is a huge campaign of conversion going on. Christianity always felt that it was strong intellectually. They always felt if it got a fair hearing, people would convert. I mean, obviously, free will is involved here. And so the rulers of Spain, while this is going on, would force the Jews to listen to sermons, or there would be disputations between priests and rabbis. And one of the famous ones was, it was in Spain. St. Vincent Ferrer was involved, beginning of the 15th century, I believe. This is all in the Jewish revolutionary spirit. They say to the rabbi, there's Jesus in the Talmud. It says that Jesus was a bastard. And the rabbi says, well, that's not that Jesus. We're talking about a different Jesus. Well, this is the kind of flimsy type of defense they had. Some Jew said this is the beginning of Jewish humor when they said that. Of course, the rabbis were completely defeated whenever this happened, whenever there was an honest disputation. And as a result, large numbers of Jews converted to Christianity. Huge numbers of Jews, as a matter of fact. By the end of the 15th century, the church was debating what to do with all this property. Now, this was a great success, but there was a problem in the middle of the success, because a lot of the Jews were not sincere in their conversion. Because the difference between a Jew and a Christian is a Christian has to die for his religion. If the emperor tells you you have to offer incense up to idols, you have to say, no, I'm not going to do that, even if you die as a result. The Jews would never do that. And many Christians felt this was proof that the Jews didn't even believe in their own religion. If you're not willing to die for it, how sincere are you, or what kind of religion is this? So there was led to the Converso crisis in Spain. The Spaniards brought the Inquisition in, the Dominicans in, to try and sort out the problem. No Jew was killed, but many pertinacious Christian conversos, some were burned at the stake if they refused to repent. And so as a result, the Spanish leaders got disgusted and they said, sorry, we can't resolve this. We're kicking the Jews out. And as a result, what you did was you spread revolution. So the Jews in general left. They were considered traitors because they collaborated with the Moors during the Reconquista. And the Jews left, and some of them went to Turkey, and their descendants ended up working for Ataturk during that revolution. And a lot of them went to the Spanish Netherlands, to Amsterdam. And at that point, this is where they began to collaborate with the English, who were now was now run by the Protestants. And so what you had here was the beginnings of a anti-Catholic alliance, basically against Spain, which was the premier world power, Catholic world power. And that was the Spanish Armada, all of the legends, the English legends about Sir Francis Drake as the great, sailor when he was a pirate and a terrorist. All these legends come about at this time when there was a large collaboration between the Jews in Amsterdam and the English Protestants.
Right. So it's pretty much revolution against Christians then, wherever they are. It's the Christians that they're going after. They're not setting off revolutions in Turkey against the Turks. It's to persecute the Christians, particularly the ones at Smyrna. I think they wiped out the whole population there. So when about the time of the Protestant Revolution took place, then this is something we don't hear much about. We hear about the Protestants and we hear about the Catholics, but we don't hear much about the Jewish intrigue that was behind that. I mean, for instance, one of the things I was surprised to learn about was the Jews printing off Bibles, printing off their own translations of the Bible, which I suspect is right. Probably why Catholics were against Bibles being printed up in the first place, was for reasons like that. So could you talk a bit about the Jews and the Protestant Revolution and the sort of things that they were getting up to in that?
Yeah, I think that revolution broke out in Europe with the Hussites in Bohemia in the 15th century. Jan Hus was burned at the stake in 1412. The revolution broke out 5 years later. And Prague was obviously the center of the revolution in Bohemia. And Prague was always a Jewish city. I mean, it was a crucial link in the Jewish slave trade and all sorts of Jewish trading. So the Jews had a lot of power in Prague. And as I point out in the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, they were heavily involved in supporting the Hussites. There's absolutely no question they were working together with the Hussites, because anytime someone rose up against the Catholic Church, the Jews were willing to supply them with weapons and money to destroy the Catholic Church. There's just no question. The other angle of it is that the Hussites themselves, once you break with the Church as the authority, what's your authority going to be? Well, the Reformation tended to look upon the Bible independently of the Church as the Bible. And once you look at the Bible without the Church, you're immediately drawn to the Old Testament, because it's much more interesting. And you immediately see yourself as this Old Testament prophet or Old Testament king like David. And that's precisely what happened to the Hussites. Jan Zielewski would carry two swords through the city. He was both pope and emperor at the same time. Jan Bokelzoon, 100 years later in the Anabaptist rebellion, exactly the same thing. That revolutionaries tend to be Judaizers. The classic example would be the Puritans in England. Classic Judaizers. So the Hussites is the beginning of the revolutionary movement in Europe. When the Reformation breaks out in Germany in 1517, Thomas Munzer goes to Prague, picks up the revolutionary ideas of the Hussites, and including the military tactics of Jan Žižka, one of the great generals of European history, brings them back. And the peasant revolt is basically a manifestation of this Jewish revolutionary spirit. Now, Luther hated Munzer, and Munzer hated Luther. This was the civil war that immediately followed the Reformation. And Luther sided with the princes, Philip of Hesse in particular, and basically told the princes to slaughter the peasants, which is what they did. Munzer was a terrible general, unlike Žižka. He got the idea of battle wagons from Žižka, but put them at the bottom of the hill. You have to put them at the top of the hill because the cavalry charge can't, the horses won't run into a wall. And that's what Jan Žižka realized. But unfortunately, Munzer put them at the bottom of the hill in this big battle. The peasants panicked. And if you run away from a horse, you're going to lose. And that's what happened. The peasants were slaughtered, and the peasant revolt, collapsed. And the result was that Luther took over the Reformation in Germany, and he handed all the power to the state and basically got in return a comfortable life as head of the state church. That's exactly what happened in England. There was no theological justification whatsoever for the Reformation. It was pure and simple a looting operation. The king, Henry VIII, and the aristocracy saw all this church property, and they simply could not restrain themselves. They could not restrain their lust and their greed, and they simply stole the property. And for the next couple, basically, there was never a justification. If you think of something like Luther coming up with a theology of Reformation, it never existed in England. It was pure and simple looting operation. The state, they created a state church. They were part of the looters too, and they simply took over administering the people, the spiritual end of the story. That's pretty much the beginning of the revolutionary movement in Europe. Calvin is the other great example of this. A lot of the English became Calvinists. Calvinists was studying under a Jew in Winterthur, and he knew that people found that under a rabbi, and he knew if the people found out that he would lose credibility, so he tried to hide it, and eventually had Michael Servetus murdered, executed, burned at the stake, because he was a Unitarian. And he knew that, I think it's just too sensitive here, because Unitarianism is what the Jews believe in as well. So the whole beginnings of the Reformation were simply either people pretending to be Jews or actually working with the Jews to overthrow the Catholic social order of Europe.
Well, that answered another question of mine as well, because I knew that the Jews worked with the nobles and they worked with the kings as well. They were owned by the kings. So I was wondering, well, how could they stir these peasants up? But the simple answer is with their money, isn't it? Really? That was the way they did it. They could just afford to pay the people and bribe them into doing whatever it is that they wanted them to do. Well, it was about this time also that Freemasonry was starting to get involved. And I know you've written a bit about the Kabbalah and how a lot of these Protestants were fascinated by this Jewish magic and inserting that into things. So how much link do you think there is between Jews and Freemasonry? Do you think the Jews actually started Freemasonry off, or was it a tandem operation with the Protestants as well?
Well, Freemasonry has certain Jewish characteristics. Its mythology is based on the building of the temple, Solomon's temple. But Freemasonry begins when the Whigs took over the lodges in 1721. At this point, they used them as an engine of covert warfare. And basically against the Bourbon monarchy in France. The whole 18th century was basically weaponizing of Freemasonry against to overthrow what was then the greatest Catholic power in Europe, namely France. France had succeeded, defeated Spain, and now France was the great Catholic power. And all of English energy went to basically destroying France at this point. Freemasonry, major proponents and architects of the new Freemasonry, which is basically taking over from the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which went all the way back to actually people who were Masons who actually built things. But by 1721, it had been reformed. And one of the people who was involved in this was de Sagulier, who was a Huguenot, a French Protestant who had come to England, made the acquaintance of Isaac Newton. And actually, Newton was de Sagulier's son's godfather. They were closely connected. And de Sagulier was the guy who basically integrated Newtonian physics into the Masonic Lodge. It was part of what the Freemasons were now proposing. And it was a powerful instrument. Newtonian physics is also a form of, Newton was heavily involved in alchemy. Some people call him the last alchemist. He and John Locke, the pillars of the English Enlightenment, actually held alchemical experiments in Newton's apartment. And so you're talking about, this is the English, John Dee, English alchemy, refined, purged of its old associations, old pagan associations. Gravity and inertia are really love and strife. He got that from Empedocles, but it's all purged and reworked and weaponized, first of all, as a science as opposed to magic, even though there was elements of magic involved in it. And secondly, as a form of a political revolution. And this is the role that the Masonic lodges played throughout that in the 18th century in their attempt to actually ultimately successful attempt in overthrowing the Catholic government of France. It led to the French Revolution.
So they're really involved in every sort of revolution then, even in scientific revolution. And I've always looked at the Enlightenment as really a sort of darkening. It seems to be from that moment on that we lost our faith and became far more materialistic and seemed to become separated from God. And all that leads on from these big splits in the church and these revolutions being sowed by the Jews. Well, that sort of takes us up to about the French Revolution time, and that was the time that the sexual liberation really started. Is that right? Is about that time?
Yeah, let me take a step back here. As of the 18th century, the Jews were not involved in anything even remotely called science. The only exception was Spinoza in Holland, and he was expelled from his own synagogue because he was considered heretic. The Jews had been traumatized by the story of Shabbatai Zvi, the Messiah that turned out converted to Islam. They were completely traumatized, and they were living in little shtetl in Poland at the time. So they're completely out of commission until the Enlightenment in Berlin, when people like Moses Mendelssohn start to adopt the practices of the Enlightenment, and gradually Enlightenment spreads through the shtetls of Germany. But I'm sorry, I lost track. What was your question?
No, that's the French Revolution. That's fantastic. Just learning about that and the way that they knew nothing about science and then inserted themselves into it. And it was just making me think then about how many of them, the way they award the Nobel Prize to each other nowadays and how much they make about
the Jews
Einstein.
Were not involved in science at this point. They were not involved. It began gradually with Mendelssohn and people like Solomon Maimon writing memoirs about what it was like to live under the rabbis in Lithuania and places like that. And gradually the Enlightenment started to spread into the shtetl, into the Pale of the Settlement, which was at that point the western border of Russia. And this is where the revolutionary movement started in earnest, because the Jews did not speak a Slavic language. They spoke Yiddish, which was a form of German. And so as a result, they were very receptive to German writings. And this is the time of Karl Marx. And Karl Marx was to the Jews in the Pale of the Settlement what whiskey was to the Indians. They became completely intoxicated by this new revolutionary movement, because in many ways it conformed better to their notion of themselves as revolutionaries than the life that they were living in the shtetl. You know, the fiddler on the roof, that type of life. They lived a separate existence, and now they had some type of revolution. The revolutionary fervor broke out in the western part of Russia, and it became incredibly powerful. The Tsar knew that they had problems. They just couldn't get the Okhrana, the secret police, knew the Jews were involved, that the Jews were the basis of the revolutionary movement in Russia, and yet they didn't have enough intelligence to get a hold of them. The Jews could retreat into the shtetl, and the Russians couldn't find them. And so as a result, they used the shtetl as the basis for importing, first of all, revolutionary ideology of the type of Marx and Engels, but also dynamite. The Jews are the first people to bring dynamite into Russia. The printing press, all of the instruments of modern revolution. The dynamite was used to blow up the Tsar, the railroad tracks for the Tsar's train. And eventually they killed the Tsar in 1881 in St. Petersburg. There was a reaction. Many Jews left, and they came to the United States.
Right, that takes us a little bit further on from where I was just thinking about. I was just remembering when you said that the sexual liberation side of it, that didn't come in until the French Revolution. That was slightly before what was happening in Russia here. So that was with Marquis de Chardin. And what was the sexual liberation side of it, the sexual freedom side of it in the French Revolution?
That's right. You're right. I skipped over this side. So at the moment of the French Revolution, has succeeded, and there's a Catholic reaction. And the Marquis de Sade, who in many ways is considered the man who started the French Revolution. He was a prisoner in the Bastille. He was a sexual degenerate. He used his time there to write pornography, including Justine, the most famous pornographic work of all of that time. And made a loudspeaker out of his urinal and urged the mob to storm the Bastille, and they did. And he was liberated, and so he was a big supporter of the revolution. The reaction came, the Catholic reaction was known as the Vendée, which is the section they came from. And at this point, de Sade, trying to save the revolution, wrote Yet Once More, Frenchman. It's part of his philosophy of the bedroom. And in this, he says basically, we need to rekindle revolutionary passion, it's the same thing as sexual passion. So what we need to do is have the women display themselves naked in the theaters. Now, this is the beginning of the use of sexual liberation as a political weapon. This is the beginning of it. It would be, this is what would get refined over the next two centuries into the use of pornography, of sexual liberation as one of the main forms of political control in the world today. He's the father of he's just the father of sexual revolution. That's what he is. It goes back to the French Revolution.
Could you explain a bit about why the freedom to indulge in sexual desires is not freedom at all, and that it's really slavery?
Well, first of all, it's not really the freedom to indulge in sexual desires. It's the mobilization of that desire. We're talking about the political mobilization of something. There's always a technological element involved to this thing. So the stronger you have communication technology, the stronger you will have these instruments of sexual liberation to control people. But the basis of it goes back to what I said about Logos. We are creatures of logos, which means reason. Reason has to control our lives. And we have to choose the good. We're not fish. You know, salmon don't choose to have sex. They have electrochemical reactions that go off, and then they spawn, and then they die. We have to make choices in this regard. And the only way we can make choices and achieve the good is by following reason. So we have instincts as well, because we're animal and we have the sexual passion. What we have to do in order to lead successful lives is have reasonable control over the sexual passion. Reasonable control means we have to understand what it's there for. It's there for the procreation of children. If you're involved in the procreation of children, if you're going to beget a child and you want to be successful, you have to raise the child. And that involves a 20-year or so proposition, whatever. And in order to have that, in order to do that successfully, you have to have stability, which means you have to have marriage, which means you have to stay together with the woman so that both of you raise you. All of this stuff is part of the rationality of sexual behavior. Okay. All of this gets short circuited with sexual liberation, because basically what you're saying here is that the passion is the important thing and passion rules reason. That's what the liberation is. Well, you can't be liberated from reason if you're a rational creature. And the point when you do act that way, what you're doing is enslaving yourself. And that's good from the point of view of the people who we now call the oligarchs. They want a world of slaves. They want people who can't figure out their own best interest. And they want people whose passions they can manipulate as a form of controlling. That is the whole history of sexual liberation in a nutshell. It's always portrayed as freedom, but it's always promoted by the oligarchs as a form of control.
No, I say, and eventually it leads to the giving away entirely of reason. A lot of the thinkers on the left have been psychopaths. And Marquis de Sade went insane. There was Lenin he had problems with his brain. There's a lot of them that have all had these mental issues. And I would say that this separating themselves from reason is the end result from that. I think there's a big link between sex and death as well. There's certainly a link between sodomy and usury, in that both of them can't actually produce anything natural. I believe you've spoken a little bit about that before as well. So maybe you could talk a bit about the link between banking and usury and sodomy, and how it all ties in together with keeping us distracted from what the bankers and the oligarchs are doing to us.
Well, I mean, the beginning is Dante's Inferno, because he puts sodomites and usurers in the same circle in hell. So the sodomite takes what is fruitful, namely sex, and makes it sterile. The usurer, on the other hand, takes what is sterile, namely money, and makes it fruitful through compound interest or usury. And that's the classic Christian understanding of these two things. Now you can tell this is hell. They're in the same circle in hell. Okay. So you can tell that this is the devil's work. Now it's really the devil's work when you bring these two things together. And that is precisely the system that is the American system. This is the America is the great Satan, and Satan doesn't put a gun to your head. Satan corrupts your morals. And so we have a system that is based now on sodomy and usury. Okay. The great architect of this system was the French philosopher Michel Foucault, who was himself a homosexual. He was the leading European intellectual in the 1970s. He had taken the mantle of philosopher king from Jean-Paul Sartre. And in 1979, he made a pact with the devil. This is not my term. It's his term. And James Miller, his biographer, talks about it the same way. And what was the pact with the devil? Basically, the left had always had an economic critique. There was always an element of sexual liberation in the left. And so what Foucault did went to the oligarchs. Actually, the oligarchs went to him. They appointed him a professor at the University of California in Berkeley, an oligarch institution. And it was there that he proposed a deal. You let me have unlimited perverse sex in the bathhouses of San Francisco during the 1970s, and I won't criticize your economic system. That's the system that exists today. That is the system. The left was betrayed, or the left willingly betrayed itself. They no longer talk about economics. All the left talks about is gender ideology, homosexual marriage, and now the reductio ad absurdum of it all, where you can go to the bathroom in North Carolina, or who can go into which bathroom. This is the net result of this total betrayal of the left itself, and also of its critique, its economic critique. Nobody talks about economics anymore. The homosexual mayor of Berlin said, "Wir sind arm, aber sexy." We're poor, but we're sexy. What he means to say here is there are going to be no more decent paying jobs. You can go into the gay disco and amuse yourself and forget about the fact that you have crappy wages. South Bend, Indiana has a mayor, a homosexual mayor. He said exactly the same thing in a puff piece in the New York Times, which anointed him as the first gay president of the United States. He came, and during that interview, he said to South Bend, Indiana, the part of the industrial Midwest, those jobs, meaning those high-paying jobs that you got from working in factories, they're gone, and they're never going to come back. And what you do is you imitate me. You go into the gay disco and forget about all your problems. That is the connection between sodomy and usury. That's the system that rules the world right now.
And that's the system that's being exported elsewhere in the world, and that other countries are being forced to take on through sanctions and through war as well, trying to enforce human rights. I mean, that's what human rights has come down to now is gay marriage and witch
bathroom. That's absolutely the system.
All right. Well, since they've moved from using blacks to folk musicians to using homosexuals, I do wondering what you think they'll be using next. Because I personally think that they're hoping to use the Muslim mass immigration that they've imported into our countries. I think that's going to be the next one that they move to using next to try and start off revolutions. Have you thought about that at all, or what they're likely to be using next? Who they're going to be using next?
Well, actually, the homosexual is currently the avant-garde of the revolutionary movement in the United States. But the predecessor of the homosexual as the avant-garde of the revolutionary movement was the black people of the United States. This began with the founding of the NAACP at the beginning, 1913, 1915, the beginning of the 20th century. What we're seeing now is a resurrection of the Black Jewish Alliance with Black Lives Matter, which has caused a huge amount of uproar. And apparently five cops were just murdered at a Black Lives Rally Matter in Dallas. George Soros, the Hungarian Jew, is the main supporter of Black Lives Matter. He spent $33 million promoting this group, which is basically promoting race war in the United States. The race issue had gone dormant. That's why the homosexuals were the avant-garde of the revolution. And now George Soros has almost single-handedly brought back violent racial politics back to the United States.
Right. So that's likely to be the next one. Well, that brings me to a final question that I wanted to ask you about. And this is along the same lines, really. I was thinking, what are some of the things we can do to help prevent the alt-right from being hijacked by the Jews to further their revolutionary agenda? Some of the ways we can avoid that from happening, because all these other groups, you know, they all thought that they were acting in their own interests, but somehow they were all hijacked by the Jews. Either by them giving them the money or just by deceiving them, out-and-out deception. So have you any ideas how we can help prevent the alt-right from being hijacked by the Jews?
Yeah, I think we have to stop talking in racial categories, because as soon as you start talking about white guys, the Jew disappears. You can't identify the Jew as the source of the problem because it's not racially clear where he stands. I gave a talk in London. I was in Washington. Sam Francis, the late Sam Francis, that brought John Tyndall in. And it was, John Tyndall was saying, you know, we white guys have to, you know, should be proud at Elizabethan England. And I said, wait a minute, Elizabethan England, I would have been drawn and quartered in Elizabethan England. I'm not an enthusiast of Elizabethan England because I'm a Catholic. And so after the gave his talk, my friend said, are the Irish white? And he said, yeah, my mother's Irish. And then Sam Francis turned to him and said, are Jews white? Well, that was a tough question for Mr. Tyndall. He didn't know what the answer to that was. Well, the problem here is if you're thinking in categories of white guys, the Jew is invisible. And that's the problem. You can't tell who the source of the problem is. I think we need to go back to the whole point of the Jewish revolutionary spirit is to create the proper categories. The Jew is a theological construct. He's not a racial construct. He is not the seed of Abraham. The Jews today are not even, the Ashkenazi are not even Semitic people. They're Turkic. The issue is the Jew. What is the Jew? The Jew is a rejecter of Christ. The Jew is a rejecter of Logos. That's why he's dangerous, because he's constantly promoting some type of revolutionary overthrow of Logos. And so I'm saying the best solution throughout European history was the Catholic solution. the Middle Ages, nobody knew they were white because they'd never seen a black person. And yet they had to deal with Jews, and they dealt with them by through secret Judaeus non. Okay. Nobody can harm the Jew, but on the same token, the Jew has no right to destroy your culture. I think that's the best solution to this problem.
Well, I think the Jews aren't white, personally. I know the rabbis have made a big, some of them made quite a big thing about this, reminding them that they're not actually white. But then they claim to be white when they write pieces about white guilt and white privilege.
That's
they
right.
Often
you're absolutely. They will do whatever suits them. They will choose it to be white or not white according to their own convenience, but it never gets to the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is the rejection of Logos. That's why they're dangerous. That's why they have caused problems throughout European history.
Well, I agree. I agree with you there. You also get the Jews that say that they're atheist Jews or they're Jews for Jesus. So I'm not so sure that when they claim to have changed their theological views, whether they still remain the same, whether this Jewish character, I know you get different racial types of Jews, but there always seems to be this certain biological component to it. And one of the ways that they did deal with it was by giving them a Jewish star to wear, and that helped the people to differentiate between them and themselves because they do look very much like white people. So I know there is that confusion there, but that was the reason why they did that. It wasn't so that they could pick on them, so that they could go after the guy with the Jewish star. It was so that people were warned about that and warned to be a bit more careful in their presence, I think. And we've even seen them pretty much doing this to themselves just recently on Twitter. They've been putting parentheses around their own names, which has been quite hilarious. I don't know if you've heard about that at all or come into any contact with that. That pretty much brings us up to the end of the podcast, Michael. I'm very pleased that you agreed to come on here and be interviewed by me, and I'm sure my listeners are going to find this absolutely fascinating. So thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
And that concludes the interview. And I do think he has a point there at the end with what he was saying about not seeing the racial categories, but maybe not in the way that he was intending. But we do have a problem with white traitors. We can't say all white people are good. A lot of white people are not good. A lot of white people have sold us out over the years. So a way to ensure that that doesn't happen to the alt-right, I think, is a similar solution to what he's proposing there. And he's saying that it's a theological problem. Go back to being Catholic. And I would suggest that if we made a point of making certain that people actually obeyed these moral laws and kept to these moral laws and were good people, then that would keep out, that would keep the Jews out, and that would also keep out the white traitors. If we made certain that, the people we had were not involved in pornography, homosexuality, drug taking, didn't get into debt. I mean, it's getting into debt that really gives the enemy a hold over us. Once you get into debt, you can be controlled. As we know, look at Winston Churchill. He was in debt. The Jews paid off his debts, and once that had happened, he was in the control of the Jews. So if we get people that are in debt, there's always a chance that they could sell out. So I think that's what he means by not seeing it all in racial categories, because it's not black and white. We do have bad people on our side, and it is hard sometimes to tell who is a Jew and who is not. But he would say what the dividing line is the theological line, that the Jews reject Logos. And I would say that that's a biological trait. They do reject Logos. Yes, they are revolutionary, but I would say that's hardwired into their very DNA. I mean, that's where the difference is between my views and his lie, I think. I don't think they can change. I look at the trouble that these conversos caused. So I think he is right in saying that it is a theological difference, but I don't think Jews can change. I personally don't think devils can repent. Christ did say that they were the sons of the devil. So
That's the main essential thing that I suppose I differ on in my views from Professor Jones' views. But apart from that, I agree with everything that he says, really. I really do recommend that people look out his other interviews and look out his research, look out his books, check out his Culture Wars website, and don't be put off when he says, you know, there is no white race, or he doesn't agree with racial classifications. Because if you actually think about what he's saying, there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, we didn't think of ourselves as a white race until we came across blacks, until we were juxtaposed with blacks. It was only then that we saw ourselves as white people rather than seeing ourselves as Scots and Germans and Irish. That was our original ethnicity. But I think the races have got to be kept separate. I think that's the solution to our problems, is that the races have got to be kept separate. It doesn't matter what religion they are. They still need to be kept away from us. And if you look at these Jews that claim to be Christian, look at all the problems that caused. I mean, they had to have the Inquisition to root them out because they were still sticking to their Judaic practices. If you look at the Negroes that claim that they're Christians, I mean, that they turn it into voodoo and they still do all their magic and what have you. We need to be kept separate from these peoples. That's the main sort of difference that I have with Professor Jones. But everything else I say, I think he's a fantastic researcher. I've just finished reading The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, and I'm looking forward to reading Libido Dominandi. So thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Aryan Insights on Radio Aryan in the future.
You're tuned in to